You're gonna need a blanket and suntan lotion, because you're never gonna get off that beach, just the way you never got into the NHL, you jackass. The green's that way. Sure. You will not make this putt, you jackass. Nice shooting, soldier.
All right, Happy. Nice and easy. That was not nice and easy.
That guy's driving me crazy.
You know what's driving me crazy? You not getting the ball in the hole.
Don't push me, Bob. Now's not the time. Psst. Jackass!
This guy sucks.
We haven't seen Happy Gilmore play this badly since his first day on tour. He and Bob Barker are now dead last.
I can't believe you're a professional golfer. I think you should be working at the snack bar.
You better relax, Bob.
There is no way that you could have been as bad at hockey as you are at golf.
All right, let's go.
Oh! You like that, old man? You want a piece of me? I don't want a piece of you. I want the whole thing. Oh!
You're gonna get it, Bobby.
The price is wrong, bitch.
And we are back, boys. For another week of SVS Fly Fishing Podcasting. What's happening, guys?
Good weekend. I was expecting music to come on. I didn't even know you had on. It caught me off guard there.
Something was going on with our sound. I think it just cleared itself back up.
Yeah. Sounds good now. Working good.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back. Man, I missed sitting at this table last week.
It's nice having someone that knows what they're doing over there.
Doing a little diagnosing beforehand and see what Jay had done.
Oh, he made a mess.
It was a good show, though. I listened to the first segment of it. I haven't got around to listening to Nick, but from what I've heard so far, you guys did a great job without me.
We managed to get by.
Good job. Good job. Fumble your way through it.
Fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah. I guess this is not like a visual, so here we go.
No, exactly.
Hey, we're going to have a heck of a lot to talk about today.
Oh my goodness, we had a full weekend. Everyone was doing different things, and some fish were caught for a goddamn change.
And you can, you got Florida.
Yes, I do have Florida. Not a lot of fishing talk, but a lot of fish stories.
We heard so much about tarpon. We're not going to hear about tarpon for an hour?
No, not one single bit, because I didn't see a tarpon. In fact, I didn't catch a fish.
Good job, Chad.
I know.
That's typical Chad.
You know what? I am a great podcaster.
He likes to wait like 4 years to get one for certain species. So,
as a matter of fact, today we had a guy out that has waited 3 years to get a muskie. I'm not going to spoil anything, but God, I'm proud of those two boys.
Muskie fishing where you guys were doing it today. All came together, right?
It did.
Wasn't no special plans, just to go out and fish. So that's always fun when that happens.
Well, we made a game plan and we stuck to it, and I'm not gonna spoil it. We'll get to my story after our guest tonight, which is Patrick Cassidy, Cape Cod on the Fly. Go check him on Instagram. And I will say one more thing. Tonight's show brought to you by Predator Fly Gear. Check him out at predatorflygear.com. Mm-hmm.
Arx Hooks, whenever you're tying, they got something for it. Check them out, arxhooks.com.
SimsFishing.com. Check the all the rain gear and all the stuff they got is just magnificent. It's built for type of stuff you want to be in to catch the big one, you know?
Hey, quantities are limited, but if you need some hackle, go check out Alsdorf Genetic, and you can check that out at urbanflycompany.com. And while you're there, pick up one of Mark's flies. They're by far one of the best musky flies I've thrown.
Well, thank you.
You know.
And also, why not fishing? Check out their app, The Dock. Meet up with some other guys and go throw some musky flies. There's a handful of them on there.
That and one more thing. Let's shout out Queen City Guiding. Ryan came down and spent the weekend with us. And if you guys need to book a trip up in the Buffalo area, that's a dude you should check out. Ryan, he knows how to have a good time and he can catch some fish.
Fall steelheading's coming up, so get your prime dates. He definitely loves to get out after those. Might be a little, I don't know, depends on what kind of guy you are. He'll let you bobber fish, I guess.
We were in the boat today and did nothing but talk about Euro nymphing. That's all he wanted to talk about. I like me some Czech nymphing. I like Czech nymphing this, bobbercating that, you know.
I bet he did. We did. I fished with him. I got to fish with him. So yeah, shout out to him, man. It was awesome. Awesome for him to come down and, you know, kick it as usual. It's sweet to meet people through all this. You know what I mean? I didn't even know people fished outside of here before I really got in tune with like the social media and stuff. And there's great people and a lot of fun to be had on there. So shout out there, Ryan, for coming down, and I enjoyed fishing with you, bud.
Hey, let's do a little chronological weekend recap, and then we'll start with you, Jace. Before
he came in town.
Well, I guess you want to hit on early in the week. Isn't Jay coming?
Actually,
spent a long day out there. Oh yeah, that's right. You guys fished what, Friday?
Yeah, we fished some like. I wouldn't say the greatest times, but if you're in town and there's water, that's the best time to fish. Like, so as soon as he got off the highway and made his way right into our little, you know, rusty town here, we went down, like, did some urban fishing and, you know, waited for our bites, I guess. It seemed like bided our time, but lots of downtime. But as soon as we got there, we pull up, you know, we picked the fly before we even get there, pull up, walk right down.
Did you change the fly?
No, he had the right idea. He tied me a pretty awesome fly. Big, it's quite long. I don't know that. I wouldn't say that's a downfall, but they could miss it.
It's quite long.
But it swam okay, I guess. You know, fouled up here and there. But he was fishing one right off the get go. I was like, yeah, throw that, and puts it down there. He tied him, you know, fresh to come up here and do the striper fishing. So definitely was a fly that worked. He caught one right off the get go, and we were throwing like some bigger stuff at first. Got into some fish. First fish he had, he fights it all the way in, and it just somehow turns off the hook. Like, and then it like paused on top of the water to look at us, 3 foot out. I was like, well, man, what happened? But
it was like Baker Mayfield giving a stare down after throws a touchdown pass.
It was definitely the middle finger, and then I was like, yeah, next time you hook one, just put the rod down and bury it to the side. Don't even give him no chance. You know, all side, and it was a moment. He was like, go ahead and fish. So I threw out like the 5 casts and whack one. I was like, I'm only going to show you this one more time. And I swung one up real quick. We were just throwing like, I don't know, 3 to 5 inch bait patterns. I think his was a little bit bigger the first fly he was fishing. So after that, the fish seemed numb to it. They were like, yeah, right. Fish I landed was a good one, 22 or something. And I caught solid fish, all 22 to 24 maybe.
So you let Ryan catch the dinks?
Well, no, he caught fish he caught a fish right up there at that size. But the thing was like the bite turned off. We fished. We actually tried both sides because there's no like water so high right now. There's no getting in and working an area. It's like all shore fishing. So we were fishing where we could when we could. And other side didn't produce. Came back to the side we started on that we caught a fish and lost one and then got in the groove. I was like, man, you gotta change fly. I'm just saying it. Change flies.
Is that when he put the tarpon fly on?
Yeah, I pointed at it because I seen them big eyes. I was like, yeah, that right there. That one right there because, like, I don't know, they're just numb to our big fly. We can't deceive them that good anymore. So threw the more of a, I guess, what you would find in our river, 3-inch, 4-inch bait fish, and wham, he gets into a fish. So it was pretty fun. He actually had I think, two fish on that fly. And till it got broke off. And it was a fly that was gifted to him, he said, from a guy that when he went down and hooked that big snook down in Florida.
He hooked a tarpon on it.
Or a tarpon snook, yeah. Tarpon, he actually hooked on it. So he blew an eye off. And this is rough fishing, dude. I'm proud of him. He did good. And it ain't like it's the prettiest place, like tetanus required and good shit, you know what I mean? Downtown, but
make sure you're current on all your shots.
Yeah, it was like we're seriously fishing for sharks because there's no other fish to even come around the area. Like we weren't fluking a smallmouth bass here and there to keep us interested. So it was tiresome not to really do the same thing. It's just wait them out, make the right choice, and hopefully it worked. But they turned on. We took a handful of fish real quick. We ended up laying in six for the day, and he lost that first one and got broke off near the end by a big fish, bigger class than all the ones we caught. So probably a fish maybe up 27 plus inch range, who knows. But I seen it. I'm on the phone with Jason actually to see when he was coming over to hang out with you guys. And
leave it to Jay, fucking something up.
Oh, we had a good day fishing, but we're right there. I'm kind of thinking it, you know, whenever you want to go, it doesn't matter. You cast as many times as you want. I didn't fish much, like I said, because them fish, man, to catch one is a blessing. To catch more than that is a hell of a day. Like you remember when they hit. You don't not feel it, you know. But he did good. He landed his share, but the big one got away. And he I'm sure that's haunting him right now. Cause he knew it was a big fish. I knew it was a big fish. Seen the rod, like the line rip upstream. Like there was no doubt that this was a good sized fish.
In between bobber talk today, he definitely talked about that fish a couple times.
Oh, I'm sure it's in his memory. It was vivid.
Bobber, 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 bobber. Bobber, 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 bobber. Tight line nymph, bobber, bobber, hybrid, bobber, bobber, bobber. So you had mentioned shark, and we only have a couple minutes, so no use getting into another fishing story, but can I tell a shark story from when I was in Florida last week?
Were you fishing for him?
You'll get into that. But my brother-in-law and myself, we were like, oh, Sunday, we really want to wake up early and go try to catch a shark. So I told my wife, I was like, Ash, I'm sunburnt. I want to go catch a shark tomorrow morning, and we don't have a rod. So my brother-in-law, he's very fluent with the pawn shops down there. So we drove around. We hit a bunch of different pawn shops, and we ended up finding a rod at a flea market. So bought a rod for $25. And while we were out pawn shopping and flea marketing, my wife took my two nieces and my son to the beach. So they were swimming in the beach, and my wife is scared of the ocean. Totally scared. They're in there probably 15 minutes, and she's finally getting a little bit at ease. She ended up going like belly button deep, which my wife is super short. It's 3 feet off the bank. So my niece is like, Aunt Ashley, we should get out. She said that, and my wife looked up, and there's a 10-foot shark 5 feet away from them, just cruising the
So she's the done shore. Done with going 3 feet out?
Yes. She didn't go out the rest of the day. They ran to shore and were watching it, and the shark was swimming along. I guess it bumped into a little kid. Like, it bumped into his leg. And the little kid, they said he walked on water to get out of there. So, they were walking up the shore watching this fish. And it swam underneath a dude on a paddleboard. And I guess the dude on the paddleboard saw it. He was pointing at it with his paddle. Like, I don't know if he's got a spirit, if it came up or something.
It's top water.
But they said that shark was bigger than the paddleboard. That shit is scary. We saw one the very first day we were there. We were in the ocean and walking out. My brother was like, there's a 2 foot blue or black tip. So, 2 foot black tip. What do you do?
It is the ocean there, guys.
We went out deeper.
Like I said, here is heavily known for sharks too.
We were in Daytona Shores, which is right next to the Halifax where it dumps into the ocean. If you go on the other side of the Halifax, that's New Smyrna Beach. And that, they were telling me, is the shark bite capital of the world.
Like you're like right there by it.
Yeah, we're a river away. But it was cool. We saw people surfing. I got to surf on an inflatable rubber duck. It was pretty cool. There was there's an old Indian lady on the shore taking videos of us. We didn't know her. She was taking videos of us surfing on this rubber duck. But we did end up going shark fishing the next morning, the Sunday morning. We woke up at like 4 in the morning. We're like, all right, we're going to go. We're going to get out there. We were trying to be quiet because my wife was sleeping in the living room. Everyone else in the house was sleeping. So we were looking. We're like, it's 4 in the morning. The bugs aren't going to be bad. Yeah. We got out there, and the no-see-ums were so bad. My legs looked like I had leprosy. I must have had 150 bites on my legs. And God, I think we lasted 35 minutes.
That's probably the only time in Florida that bugs probably are like our evening bugs. You know what I mean? That it's cool enough for them to operate like that.
Well, my brother-in-law was telling me that they normally have a nice beach breeze. And this year, the breeze has just died, and it's just been sweltering heat, so nothing to blow the bugs away. Oh. Yeah, it was rough.
That's what ended up getting us out last night, was just skeeters were so bad. You're trying to strip the fly back in, you're just swatting them off you. And
oh, yeah. That's rough. That bugs suck. We went fishing on Wednesday after work. We'll get to that story after our guest. But I know I saw one mosquito on me. Nuts to it. Throw that deed on.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we left it in the truck yesterday. Not a good idea.
No. Deed's your friend.
Bad the whole year, though. We've had a wet year.
All this water and heat.
Dude, it's just like, no, they get me every night. I'm trying out to enjoy that moment, you know, half hour before sunset where it's actually cooled down and they tear me up.
I don't know. Has anyone ever noticed that mosquitoes go to bed at midnight?
I think they're a lot less thick right after dark.
I've never got bit after midnight.
That's because you're drunk after midnight. You don't feel that shit. The mosquito sucks your blood and dies.
I think Jace is onto something there.
The mosquitoes all get alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, they just drop. You're sweating it out by then. Midnight's coming. This guy sweat like 3 beers out already. They're like, no, we don't want to bite that shit.
I wonder how much, though, too. The alcohol doesn't have to do with it.
Probably a good idea.
It doesn't jack the mosquito up or something, and they just don't go near it.
Yeah, we need a bottle of bourbon right there just for mosquito purposes.
Yeah, who needs DEET when we have bourbon?
That's it. Nobody can fuck with you on bourbon.
Speaking of that, when we were out shark fishing, my brother was like, all right, let's have a little bit of fun while we're out here. So we stopped at 7-Eleven and got big...
Four Locos?
No, we got big big Polar Pops of Coke. And he brought a bottle of rum, so we had rum and Cokes at 4 in the morning.
Hell yeah. Should have got the frosty Coca-Cola. There you go.
That would have been where it was at, but...
Is it like a long walk in, or is it just...
Yeah, it was a real long walk, because where we went, it's a park, but the park doesn't open until sunup. So we were...
Parked on a random roadside.
Yeah, random roadside, and we had to walk in, and we got chewed the entire way in. We were like, it's going to be better when we get in the water. We got chewed the entire time we were on the water. Then we were like, nuts to it, let's leave. Got chewed the entire way out. It was insult to injury. And I guess Florida residents don't need a fishing license to fish salt water.
No, not for ocean.
If they're on shore. Or on, like, not on a boat.
From the land.
So,
or wet weight or whatever.
But I guess...
Anybody on a boat.
My brother-in-law looked it up, and he needs a... fishing license to fish the intercoastal waterway, though. So we were going to go and fish that, but he needed a fishing license then, so we said, let's do it, let's go back to sleep.
You didn't try any of the ditches or they pointed you to? Or
I made about 20 casts, but it ended up being more of a family vacation, and I didn't want to make it about me and making content for the podcast, so... We just ended up doing family things and skimboarding and surfing on ducks.
Oh, yeah. Sounds fun. Now, fishing in Florida, it's different than here. That's for damn sure.
You definitely need local knowledge, I think. Local knowledge would definitely help a lot. A
lot of water. Sure, there's a lot of water.
And we did end up going sightseeing, trying to find alligators.
See any?
We saw one, and it was way off in the distance. But where'd we go? We went to the Daytona Raceway, the Speedway, and across the street from there, there's, they call it the Auto Mall, just a bunch of different car dealerships right in a row. And behind that, there's a bunch of retaining ponds. And they said they always see gators there, except when Northerners come in town.
They're like, oh, they're looking for us. That would
be a good place to go fish.
Yeah, I thought about that too, but that was, we ended up doing something, and everyone was sweaty and grouchy and hungry. So, yeah.
Dude, if you're not in air condition in Florida, you're not happy.
No, absolutely not. That's one other thing I noticed about down there. Monday morning when we were flying out, we opened the door at 6 in the morning, and it was sweltering heat and like high humidity. I was like, God, they don't get a break anytime. Because the next day I had to go to work, so I woke up same time here, and it was 63 degrees.
Perfect.
Perfect temperature.
Yeah, we hit a few 55s last week. It was beautiful here.
So, but, hey, I think we should go take a break, give our guest a call, and come right back. Sound good to you guys?
Cool.
And we are back with Patrick Cassidy from Cape Cod on the Fly. How's it going, Patrick?
It's going great.
Good, man. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Hey, is there any way you could give us a little bit of background into your story of how you got into fishing and fly fishing?
Sure. I'm saltwater primarily, and that started, 30 or 40 years ago. I grew up in Virginia and was fishing around the Chesapeake Bay a little bit, but really didn't get started in saltwater until I think my father and my mother came here to Cape Cod on a romantic getaway, and my father brought a fishing rod and figured out there was good fish in here. So they started vacationing here. We started coming up here and started doing a fall trip here every year where we went out to Provincetown as a group of guys. It was anywhere from 10 to 25 guys coming from all over the place and doing that every year for the past 30 years. We're still doing it in the fall. And that was, my primary entree into pretty hardcore fishing was that trip. And then over the years, eventually ended up here on Cape Cod full time. Got a job, got a house, married a coworker, as it turns out, really started doing a lot more fishing, got a boat. Decided I was going to get serious about fly fishing. I was doing a lot of obviously spin casting and surf casting primarily, but started doing a lot more fly fishing in the past 10 years or so. And it just appealed to me, the challenge of it, and certainly fishing for striped bass and bluefish primarily. Appealed to me because they're just two great fish. I mean, they're two sides of the same coin, as I like to say. They're the fighter, the bluefish, which is great to catch on the fly, great fighting fish, obviously jumps out of the water, shakes its head, and then the striped bass, which is kind of more refined and a beautiful fish. Anybody who argues with me on that can jump in a lake, as far as I'm concerned. But I love both those fish and really enjoy just being on the water and grew to love being on the water, not only for those two species, but for everything else around here on Cape Cod. I mean, the Cape, if nobody's been here, is just filled with all sorts of species, whether it's whales or ocean sunfish or sharks or tuna or whatever you think you might see one day, you'll see something different the next day. And it's just a great place to get out and go fishing. So again, my father grew up fishing, Montauk, and I guess that's really kind of where the bug was passed down. But it was through a variety of accidents that I ended up here, and fishing just was always kind of in the blood in our family, and it's why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
So with a fly rod at Cape Cod, do you have a lot of accessibility from shore, or is it strictly boat only?
No, there's tons of accessibility from shore, and that's one of the things that's great, and I think in some ways not as well known about the Cape. Everybody talks about the flats, but the size of the flats really on the Cape is astonishing, I think, to a lot of people. I took a guy out about a week ago, and we walked out, and he said, "This is the furthest I've ever walked from shore," because we went out on the Brewster Flats, and you can walk out a mile in fairly shallow water or almost on dry sand to get to the edge where at low tide in any case. And there's just tons of areas like that, whether it's the Brewster Flats, Monomoy, all the kind of Pleasant Bay area, or fishing from the shore all up along the outer beaches or along the bay. There's tons and tons of accessibility from shore. Obviously, you know, depending on the time of the year, it might be better to get out in a boat and get a little further and deeper as the water heats up and the fish go a little deeper. But even in the high point of the summer where it's really hot at night, at dusk and at dawn, you can go to any beach and have a chance of catching some fish. And the flats really do give you that opportunity because you can walk out and go up and down the flats. There's just so much different topography out there that you can access and have a chance of catching some really nice fish.
Before we hit the mics up, you had mentioned sharks. Is that anything you have to worry about while you're walking the flats, or is it too?
It is, and you know, it's an evolving conversation here on the Cape. Obviously, everybody who goes swimming around here, and all the vacationers and folks who go surfing or do any boogie boarding are worried about it. We had the first fatal shark attack last year in 86 years in Massachusetts, I think it was. And it's a big deal for those folks, but for fishermen as well. And, you know, whether you're wading, I was talking to a guy a couple weeks ago who was wading in that area of Brewster Flats within the past few years. And he said he was out there at night. He's a night fly guy. He goes for really big flies and for really big fish at night. And he was out there and he was pretty deep up to his chest, and he heard a splash and he turned around and he shined his light on a great white going by him. So it's definitely something to think about. The way I look at it is, you know, typically I don't think a shark is looking to bite into a tree trunk, which is essentially what your legs probably look like when they're standing there, unlike a surfer who may look a little more like a seal. But it has happened that these sharks have kind of gone sideways on somebody standing in the water. So I wouldn't put it past them. And when I go out, you know, I like to stay in these days in more shallow water and keep my head on a swivel. Usually I'm in situations where it's pretty clear. And if a big animal like that is moving through the water, I mean, I'm looking for small ripples for, you know, to find fish. If a big animal like that's moving through the water, I can see a big ripple. Sure. Now, what I'm going to do if I see that is another question. That's something that I haven't had to deal with wading. But it's an ongoing conversation and one that's heightened more recently because right in that area I was talking about, the low tide mark on the Brewster Flats, which is a big area, the charter fleet on like high tide goes right through there. And they have been finding at least smaller great whites, you know, basically taking fish off the back of their boats. There was an instance just within the last couple of weeks where a shark came up and went sideways and his tail almost whacked this kid on the head who was sitting there looking over the edge watching the fish come in. So these sharks have been taking fish right off the backs of these charter boats in the same area generally where I like to go out wading and have taken some clients. So especially with clients, you know, you don't want to ever put them in a situation where something like that could happen. It's definitely something we're thinking about and talking about. I'm going to be talking this week with some folks about, you know, even release techniques. So you're on a boat and you're releasing a striped bass and trying to revive it and do the right thing and, you know, catch and release. And you've got this big striped bass in your hand and your hand's over the edge. It's the same, you know, type of situation where these sharks have been coming up and hitting these charter boats. So there's a question, okay, should, you know, have a longer boga grip? How do you deal with that? And also, again, wading is definitely, I think, a conversation that needs to be had among guides, among, you know, local folks who are, you know, encouraging people to go out and fish in those areas.
Once again, I was just down in Florida last week, and my nieces wear like a magnet ankle bracelet to try to deter sharks while they're out surfing.
Yep.
Would that work for you guys?
Yeah, it might. I think a lot of those things are being looked at, especially with the surfing community here on the Cape. I have a neighbor and another friend who are out there all the time, and they have now on their boards the same, a little more powerful version of that, but it's a, you know, an electromagnetic field that's created to try and keep the sharks from coming close to. Those are a little more proven. The bracelets and things, I think, you know, all of that sort of technology is still being sussed out as far as what works and what doesn't work. So I don't know if I'd, you know, go out with that and feel perfectly comfortable, then a shark's not going to come by. These sharks actually here on the Cape, and again, this is only in the last 15 years or so that the numbers of them have really been coming here. They've always been out there, but just in the large numbers. They're in kind of murkier water than great whites in other areas. And it seems like, according to the experts and people I've talked to about this, that a lot of the attacks might be something where it's almost a surprise, as much a surprise to them as it is to the seal or to whatever they're hitting. And therefore, you know, would that bracelet or anklet or whatever electromagnetic field, or would it be, would it stop them, or would it be more like a dog running through a dog fence, an electric dog fence, and just going through it full speed? Open question to me. So, you know, I'm not going to, not necessarily going to be investing in that right now more than anything. It's just knowing that when you're in certain places, to make sure to keep your eyes open, not to go too deep, and to be aware of your surroundings at all times.
Well, since we're talking about that, can you get into your release techniques a little bit if you're in sharky water?
Sure. I mean, it's evolving right now, as a matter of fact. And like I said, I'm going to be talking to some people about, you know, kind of education and trying to figure out if there's different ways that things should be done. The boga grip is certainly a good idea. It gives you a little bit extra, and the longer the boga that you can have, the better. Everybody, again, wants those stripers to, you know, swim away, and the ones that you don't keep, make sure they're healthy when they leave. For smaller fish, you know, smaller stripers, in any case, you can usually dive bomb them back in the water. And the same with bluefish. They're pretty lively, and if you shoot them into the water pretty quickly after getting them to the boat, they're doing all right. But that's part of it, is actually not only getting them to the boat faster and getting them, you know, back into the water faster for the sake of the fish, but also for the sake of the faster you can do that, the less you'll have to deal with that release on the other side, and the less position you'll be in to possibly get have a shark come up. I haven't heard, just for the record, I haven't heard of it happening where somebody's releasing a fish and a shark has come up and done anything, but it seems like it's probably only a matter of time. You know, for one thing, it's probably good to have other people on the boat watching out as you're doing that, so that, you know, there can be a warning if somebody sees one coming. That's you know, even more so the case when you're in, again, very sharky waters. Certainly, I wouldn't allow a client to be leaning over and releasing a fish at this point. I'd make sure that I'm doing it, because I have my head, again, on a swivel and always looking around. But if I'm there with a client, I would say to them, and I think I did this the other day, said, hey, listen, why don't you guys keep your eyes out around me and make sure that nothing's coming? But I think the real answer is some sort of longer boga grip, and the longer you can make that reach to the fish's lip, the better chance you have of kind of backing off at that point. And also, when you're reeling in, not having everybody crowded right up against the edge, because even that can be dangerous, from what this kind of video has shown of this kid who literally almost had the tail hit him right on the nose. So just making everybody aware and having everybody be a little extra cautious.
So in order to get them in quick, are you guys using what, mainly 10 weights, or are you going even bigger than that?
I mean, 9 weights is standard, but when you're going for the really big fish, yeah, 10 weights would be the way to go. I guess it really depends on the situation, because if I'm waiting, you know, and you know you're in an area where you're a little safer, you're not, you want to have a earlier in the season too, with you're looking for smaller fish. As the season goes on, you're kind of going to up that weight of that rod. But by the time you get to the point where you're really out in those areas, 9 weight, 10 weight, I don't go that much bigger than that, to be honest with you. So, you know, I feel like if you're, you know, fishing for those big fish, you should be able to work them in, and make sure that, you know, just that your line's not going to snap. I I don't think that it would be beyond a 10 weight as far as I'm concerned.
You mentioned like the progression of your season a little bit. Do you want to take us through, you know, your season when the bigger fish or smaller fish are coming through and if your flies change at all?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, early on, you're talking the end of April, beginning of May, really starting to look for fish coming in, and they will be coming in. You know, there's areas, you know, of Chatham, there's the Brewster Flats where you start to see them. Obviously, they come up to the Cape, and I don't venture kind of more to the west myself. I focus on the lower Cape and Nantucket Sound and Cape Cod Bay. But you start to hear the reports in, you know, Buzzards Bay, and then you start to hear the reports along the south side of these fish coming up. And obviously, these are, you know, 18 inchers or something along those lines. And you can pretty much be going after them with your small, sparse clousers, and especially on the flats, be throwing smaller flies for these smaller fish. There's been a trend to say, well, the only reason you're catching smaller fish is because you're not throwing a big fly. So that's something that a lot of people have been looking at differently a little bit and saying, well, let's just make those flies bigger and get them into those areas where those bigger fish are. I don't think that's going to change when they show up here. So by May, you really should be starting to fish hard and figure out where they're coming. It does change seemingly every year as to where they really show up and congregate. Last year, right in the heart of the bay, right up inshore, there's a little creek there, and they were there, you know, for all of July, basically. So by the time you got to July, this creek was just filled with these fish. This year, that didn't happen. That's just an example of the fact that you can't really, you know, guarantee that fish are going to be in one place or the other. Monomoy, the rips this year have been plenty of fish, but they're nothing huge in terms of stripers. And once you get into, again, the late June, beginning of July, you're starting to look towards the Monomoy area, and you're starting to see those fish come in on the Monomoy flats. And there you're you know, looking to sight cast to them, and you're looking to throw a lot of flies at them to figure out which one they're going to take at that particular time, because those fish are in such skinny water. I mean, seeing them in 6 inches of water, they're super spooky. They're not there, it doesn't seem like they're to feed. They're there to roll around and get the sea lice off them, and then they may go out to the rips to feed on the squid. So really figuring out what they're going to eat on those flats when that's not really seemingly what they're there for takes a lot of trial and error each year, and figuring out, are they going to go for something really small and sparse, or are they looking for a little more flash? Usually it's the former on the flats. So again, it depends on where you're going. But then you know, within a 5-minute boat ride, you're in the rips off Monomoy, South Monomoy, and you're throwing ginormous squid patterns at the same fish, essentially. They're just in a different spot, barely removed from where you just were. So that's, again, late June, beginning of July. And then, you know, the bay can be hit or miss. I think the bay has changed in recent years, and one of the reasons I theorize that it's changed and that there are more fish in the bay is that we have more aquaculture in that area. There's a lot more of these aquaculture grants and oyster beds that each of the towns is putting in on the flats there. And I feel like that's established some good structure, and there's a lot more bait fish swirling around in there, and a lot more of the, you know, the oyster shells get free in their kind of structure than further even away from the, where the aquaculture grants are. So I feel like that's, you know, the flats can look pretty barren. I mean, there's a lot going on there as far as crabs and other things go, but they can look pretty barren. But with that extra structure, I feel like the bay in the last few years has really picked up as far as the amount of striped bass that are coming in there. And this year, you know, it's totally different in terms of bluefish. And, you know, I think we talked about this off the air before we started. The bluefish have come back, it feels like, and they've come back in the bay. They've come back. I was just out this morning off Monomoy, and we were catching, you know, 31 inch bluefish, different weights. You know, one you might get in that's, you know, 6 pounds and the other one is 10 pounds. They're the same length for whatever reason. So these are fish that we have not seen in these numbers in the last bunch of years. And it's been concerning to a lot of people. But that's an example of, you know, you asked me to lay out the season. If I was telling you last year, I wouldn't really probably mention bluefish too much. I would say, oh, you might pick up one randomly here or there. You might see a school. This year, they're seemingly everywhere. Small ones, big ones, they're all over the place. And on the fly, you know, catching one of those small bluefish is super fun. Catching one of those big bluefish can be almost a little disconcerting. They fight, you know, well above their weight, and they're really fun fish to bring in on the fly. But they also typically eat anything. I've been looking at schools of these small bluefish that I really had to go through and do that fly selection with, just because for whatever reason they either had a lot to eat, a lot of pogies around, or they just you know, weren't there for feeding for some reason. But that, you know, a typical season, I haven't really seen a typical season. The one thing, you know, one of the things that you can say each year is that, you know, come late July, beginning of August, it really does start to slow down in terms of daylight near shore sight fishing. It just becomes a lot harder to find these fish in shallow water. The water's warmer, everything's warmer, they're going deeper. That's when, again, you got to get out there at dawn, dusk, nighttime, all the times you don't want to be out there for the reason we were talking about earlier, sharks. So, you know, what do you go figure? But you do have to kind of get out there at those times. I feel like going towards dusk this time of year and looking for these fish as the sun's going down is really a good way to do it. And the fly selection gets a little trickier. Again, you're in situations where you may be in deeper water and you can kind of throw a bunch of different flies and they'll go after them at dawn and dusk. But if you're in the middle of the day, you're really going to have to go through the whole box and figure out what's going on at that point. And then, you know, August, you know, as August goes on, starts to heat up again, and they start to obviously get ready for their migration south. And the bluefish on what was a typical year, and hopefully is this year again, you know, are sticking around and starting to bite quite a bit. But as that starts to heat up, you're hoping for those big stripers come, you know, the end of August, September, and into October. And that's it, that camp I was talking about, I think, where I started fishing out in Provincetown. We're always looking for those fish to be hanging around through October. Hasn't been the case for the bluefish, as I said, in a lot of years, but we're really hoping that takes place out there on the Outer Cape and the surf fishing area for fly fishing, Nauset, and all those areas that a lot of people had given up on because of seals. I don't know that was really a good idea. I think there's probably been fish there all along, and I've certainly run into fish over the, you know, many years out there at different times. I think the sharks being around actually make the seals a little more cautious, and they're not just kind of lollygagging along and eating whatever they want or getting in the way of fishermen. So the sharks being around could be a good thing on the outer beaches in terms of the fish feeling a little more comfortable as they're cruising along and not having to dodge seals the whole time. So that, you know, typical has really changed, and certainly the number of seals, the number of sharks, you know, the bluefish coming, being here or not being here, it changes from year to year. And bluefish, I think the answer to them not having been here is really just a cyclical one from the sounds of it. You know, they back in the 50s, they were talking about how they didn't see a lot of bluefish, and then there were a lot of bluefish, and then they were gone, etc. So it's really probably pretty cyclical. But again, fly selection, once you get into kind of the August, September, I really, it's funny because I think I focus on chartreuse, you know, at the beginning of the season, and then go back to chartreuse towards the end of the season as well, and look for something that's a chartreuse clouser. I go through probably like everybody, you know, one year I'm really focused on deceivers, and one year I might be back to clousers, and this year it was a lot of squid patterns again because I'm spending a lot of time off Monomoy. But it depends on the year.
So for guiding throughout the season, did, say, so you know, a fisherman, woman wanted to set up a day, is that, are they going to ask for, you know, to wet wade, sight fish? Do you do the light tackle? Is that like popper fishing, like top water on off the boat, or how's that work out?
You mean in terms of kind of determining with the client what you want to do? And
yeah, is that like something they pick, or you just go do what's hot right now?
Yeah. Yeah, and so far, and again, just to be upfront, I'm just kind of getting started on the guiding side, but what I'm seeing already is that it's a conversation with the client, and that they usually come to it with some notion of what they're looking for, and then talking through that with them. Guy a month or so ago has been fly fishing Cape Cod for 30, 40 years. He probably, you know, knew as much more about it as I did, but he hadn't been out to Monomoy in a long time. And part of that was there was some cuts that occurred and people said, oh, they're not there anymore. And he said, I didn't really believe that. So he said, well, you're going out there. I'm like, yeah, I'm going out there. I'll go out there with you. And they're there. And went out and probably, you know, the first day we were out, we saw 1,000 fish. His thing was sight fishing. He wanted to see, you know, certainly see the fish and wade and see the fish that he was casting to among even a group of fish. He wanted to really find that one fish. And he was able to do that in that situation because he and I talked through it and figured out exactly what he wanted to do. Somebody else, you know, a week later was fine kind of blind casting a little bit more and was kind of just interested in hooking up and hooking his son up with a fish. And so we, you know, spent kind of more time in the rips where you can do that, and you can still sight fish there, but you're certainly equally successful by kind of casting into the rip and letting it tumble over. So that's really like kind of a conversation. I've had a couple of guys now who are, you know, freshwater fly fishermen, and they're, you know, salt is all new to them. So the conversation is basically me starting from ground zero and telling them what their options are. And if they want, you know, to start with, do you want to be on the boat? Do you want to wade? They're two different things. They cost two different things, and you'll have two different experiences. But really trying to figure out what, at least the heart of the experience that they're looking for. I really focus on that myself. I mean, the fishing is only part of it. But if you want to, you know, spend half a day wading, you're going to have a really focused spot that we're going to go to. If you want to spend a full day, we can really hit a few spots maybe and spend a lot of time out there. And maybe even, again, wade one area, get in the car, go somewhere else and wade somewhere else if it's not happening. So kind of getting a sense for how much somebody's up for and how, quite frankly, how much exercise somebody's up for. I mean, the wading can take a lot out of some people, and maybe they're better on the boat. You know, some people have gotten on board and, you know, aren't great on boats. So it's they're better when you anchor up and take them out into the flats. So asking those questions early on for me is pretty important in figuring out if somebody's going to have a problem with one particular situation, or if they're looking for one particular thing. Say, again, I want to sight fish on the Monomoy Flats. Okay, we can go do that.
Sign my tubby ass up for the boat, man.
Especially after you said shark, you know, the waiting sounded great. Then you said shark, and oh, that's easy enough. I'll just get on the boat.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's great, you know, and you know, my boat's solid, but you know, things happen out there. So you know, I feel comfortable both waiting and on the boat, and I think that again is just a matter of making sure that everybody's aware of their surroundings. And being honest with him, I took a guy out waiting, again, was a freshwater guy. And I said, as we were, you know, before actually I said it on the phone. And then again, as we were walking, I said, just so you know, there are sharks and we're going to do this in a way where it's going to be as safe as possible. But you just got to know your surroundings and we'll be looking around and not waiting out too quickly. Like, you know, in the past, you might go out where you're really up to your chest and you're going at 4 a.m. or something like that, where it's dark. All right, maybe not doing that so much anymore. Maybe it's, you know, you're waist deep and it's, you know, dawn already, so you can see around you and you can really get a bearing for where you are. I think there are slight adjustments that you have to make based on what's out there, and the sharks are just one more thing that's out there at this point.
So half day trips are for the boat then is what you're selling there.
Well, in terms of
you're a better chance at it if you're just getting into it, a better experience.
I mean the boat you can
gives
you get to some of the same places in the boat that you can get to waiting. I think waiting is, you know, a little less expensive for some people. I know some people who they won't get on a boat, but they're some of the hardest core fishermen I know, and you know, they're just waiters. That's what they do. God bless my, I go both ways, so to speak, and I'm equally happy, waiting. There are some spots where you can get way up a creek and you would be very surprised as to how far up, some of these small creeks, these big fish, you're not getting a boat up there. But you could get up there and you could get a really big fish.
So that's all like some fresh water mixed in for those fish, right?
Well, it's brackish, I suppose. I mean, there are times when I know, a couple of years ago up on the North River, a guy pulled a striper out of a marsh way, way, way up the North River. And they think that fish had gotten out of, there was like a dam that was released or something. That fish had come out of this pond where it had been living forever and ever. So, it was, you know, they're definitely brackish situations as much as anything, but the stripers, you know, especially on the bay, they'll go up those creeks and typically they'll come out and get back into really salty water.
So what size boat are you running?
I have a 20-foot Jones Brothers Cape Fisherman.
Jones Brothers, great boat.
So now what's hot fishing now? Is the blues doing a little better than the stripers, or what are you after this week?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Bluefish, big bluefish, on the bay and off of Monomoy. That's kind of the name of the game. The stripers, especially in the Monomoy area, have been smaller than normal, I guess you would say, this year. Cape Cod Bay earlier this year, the big stripers were in there. And commercial season hit and there was a lot of pressure put on them and that happens. And at the same time, you know, the commercial guys don't necessarily go way up on the flats and do that type of fishing. So there were still opportunities. But looking at bigger stripers, you're looking at maybe going to the outer beaches and out towards Race Point at this point. But for me, where my focus is kind of more the middle of the Cape area, the Monomoy area and Brewster, I'm looking at bluefish, and I'm pretty excited, to be honest with you. I love fishing bluefish. I love fishing bluefish on the fly, and I'm looking forward to getting some of these real big ones on the fly. They're just exciting, and especially for somebody who, you know, somebody who's maybe coming from a freshwater background and hasn't fished, you know, stripers or blues and doesn't kind of have any preconceived notions, they get a blue on the fly and it's like, you know, a tarpon jumping in the air and doing all sorts of acrobatics. Whereas a striper, obviously, will take you down and but getting back to you mentioned the Jones Brothers being a good boat, that's why I got it, was for fly fishing, because they are built really for what we do, and they're just super clean. And so I've even seen it really work well with people who, again, coming from a freshwater background maybe, and have, you know, adjusting to you know, longer casts and a different type of casting situation, to have that clean deck and, you know, the cleats pop down and all that sort of stuff has really been a godsend. It's a great boat.
Have you found a fly yet that'll stand up to a bluefish or a couple bluefish?
Well, I mean, I've gotten flies back, bluefish, but half the time, you're right, it's pretty much destroying the fly by the time you get it back to you. Stand up to a bluefish? No. I mean, if a bluefish is really tearing at it, then it's pretty much a mess. My uncle once, put a hook through a Coke bottle and threw it out and caught a bluefish. So I feel like I can just take a piece of my shirt, put it on a small hook and hook it to my fly rod and catch a bluefish. And that would stand up to a bluefish, I suppose, because I don't care about it. But really, bluefish are just insane. And they, I always say that once you get them in the boat, they, they got you right where they want you. They're still in control as far as they're concerned, and that's why they're fun fish. They're fighters.
Do you guys get albies quite that far north?
We do, and they're should be coming in hopefully in August and September, and we should be starting to see them. I think they are even have shown up on the islands already, and obviously they're another kettle of fish, so to speak. They're no drive you crazy, but they're great fish, and a lot of people like going out for them. Looking at hopefully a trip out to the vineyard soon to try and track them down out there, and see what I can do about that. Last year I was in deep in Nantucket Sound, and I wasn't ready for them, to be honest with you. I was fishing for stripers, and a whole school of albies came right up, right into a channel, right into a harbor, and I think I lost three flies on them because they just grabbed it and ran, and I was really going light for smaller stripers at that point. So they beat me, and they beat most people a lot of the times. But when you win, it's really a rewarding experience to get one of those in.
Do you have to change your tackle much between striper fishing and bluefish fishing and the false albacore?
Yes, and I mean, the false albacore, I think primarily you want to make sure you have a heavier tippet on and make sure that you're ready in that way, because they're just so powerful. The bluefish and the stripers, it's funny because I will throw on a leader if there's a ton of bluefish around, a metal leader on the end of a fly tippet. I don't have a problem casting that, but some people don't like it because of that extra weight at the end. That being said, what I'll first try and do most of the time, and I'm pretty successful most of the time, is going without a leader with bluefish. And that's more of a challenge, obviously. And it's not if you guys have fished bluefish or not, it's not the fish you have on that's the problem. It's all his buddies coming in, and they're all trying to get whatever he's got. And they'll just come in and nip at that line and cut it. If you're in the open water and you're on a boat, for example, it's not that big of a deal because they're not going to necessarily come right up to the boat. But again, out in Provincetown, there's a jetty, and 30 years ago we used to fish there for bluefish, and you'd see guys set up for stripers, and they'd be casting, and then a school of bluefish would come in. And you'd see each of the rods down the jetty bend as each person got a bluefish on. And then you'd see each person who didn't have a leader on, the rod would snap back up because all the other bluefish were just coming through with their mouths open and just cutting lines that were tight in the water column. So right away, everybody would then switch to a leader, obviously. But you had to really know they were coming at that point. And haven't seen that at that jetty in a long time, and looking forward to hopefully this year that being the case again, because bluefish are just fun. I don't change the, I feel like I can still get them in on what I'm using for stripers. I have a kind of a homemade tapered setup, which goes from like 25 to 12. I'd probably leave it at 16 if I knew bluefish were around, but it seems to work.
And when you're throwing a leader on for the bluefish, are you you throwing the multi?
That too complicated with it. I grab whatever's in my bag. I think I've thrown on leader that's really for spin line or a spinning rod on. I have a lot of the small ones around that are, I think, supposed to be for fly fishing. But again, I try to go without it if I can at all. So I don't focus on the leader too much for a bluefish, unless if I find myself in that situation where there's a bunch just coming like sideways in front of me because they're just going to have their mouths open.
Okay.
So if you're out blind fishing, I know, do you do a lot of top water with gear? Is that the like MO for some of the blue fishing, or
throwing a popper fly or something and getting them?
Well, I'm saying, have you done it on the fly top water? Because I know gear, that's a glutton, right? They're glutton for the top water bluefish. And
they are, stripers. Yeah, absolutely. And that was these small bluefish that were in Nantucket Sound the last couple of weeks. There have been big schools of them, and they were frustrating at first because, you know, usually you can get a bluefish to eat anything if you throw it right into the middle of the school. It's the problem of having to cut your line that's the issue. These weren't taking, deceivers and other things I was throwing them. The minute I threw a popper on, they went after it like crazy, and it was just that extra little splash that got them excited. So yeah, that certainly the popper flies. And actually, I have a bunch of material and a bunch of these flies, and I have to start trying to tie them myself. They were tied by the guy who owned my boat before me. He passed last year, and I bought it off his widow. But he was Bill Strakel. He was a great saltwater guide around here, and he tied up these poppers that were, they were called Strakel poppers. I'm not sure exactly what the secret ingredient is, but they seem to work. He has all sorts of colors and different types, and I've got all the material. I just got to start putting them back together myself because I've already lost a couple to some bluefish.
And when you say little bluefish, what's a little bluefish? Because I was in Virginia Beach last year and caught like 8-inch bluefish. They are little bluefish.
Yeah, these are probably more in the 12-14-inch range. The bigger ones that we've been getting around here are 31, you know, and up to the mid 30 inches at this point. But these are they're snappers or whatever you call them, but they're bigger than that. Probably 14 inches.
Yeah, that's a little fish.
Yeah.
Well, they still chew your fly up, yeah, right?
They're still fun.
They are, absolutely. And again, on I'll have sometimes a 7-weight rod out there, and you get one of those on a 7-weight rod, it can be a lot of fun.
Outside of those stripers and guiding, is there any other species anybody on, just something that's local or something you guys go do for fun?
Yeah, I mean, I'm focused on stripers, bluefish, albies when they come in. On Friday, we ended up with some guys, and we were a couple of the guys were doing light tackle, the two sons, and then the father was fly fishing. The sons caught stripers, bluefish. One of them got a black sea bass, which are fantastic eating. If you've never had it, it's really they scootle on the bottom. And there's a lot of them around here in the last few years. I don't target them necessarily, but you can hook up to them. And then they got a sea robin, and then one of them actually hooked a menhaden, and then that menhaden got chopped in half by a bluefish. So that was five, technically four and a half, I guess, species, if you will, that they pulled out of the water in that one day. But the black sea bass, a lot of people will go out, and they'll go out on a headboat right out in Nantucket Sound, and there's a artificial reef they put out there a few years back from some material from the local high school. And they'll put people over top of that, and people will get the black sea bass, and people love eating it. Fluke, I was talking to a guy the other day about going out with him and doing some fluke fishing. A lot of people love that. I'm a sucker for striped bass and bluefish, so I'm probably not a great person to talk to about going for other species. I won't mind doing it, and going for fluke or flounder is fun for some people, but there's just not that level of excitement, especially, you know, fly fishing for that sort of thing is not something you'd be doing. But a lot of people do like going out for those other species.
When you do find the stripers on the flats, yeah, are you ever throwing crab flies at them? Like let's say the redfish guys in South Carolina, they throw crab flies all the time. Would their flies transfer over?
Yeah, they would. I had a buddy down in, he's in Connecticut, but he fishes primarily Rhode Island, and he tied up some crab flies. And actually, Nick Mayer, who was up here, took one of those with him, and I think his wife got a fish down in Rhode Island on one of them. But yeah, the fish on the flats up here definitely will go after crab flies. It's a little trickier. You got to figure out where they're going to be, put it in front of them, and then scoot it along, obviously, in the same way you're probably talking about. But they'll definitely go for it. And a lot of people recently have been talking about baby crabs. And if you get the right hatch for these baby crabs, whether it's down in Narragansett and Rhode Island, I'm not sure, that it happens up here. And I think the talk is that it hasn't happened in the same way in a long time, when these stripers will come up and take these baby crabs. So they're almost like freshwater flies. They're so small, and put it on top of them like trout, and they'll come up and sip it like trout. So that's something that I haven't done myself, but I'm interested in figuring out if that's ever possible, because that would be interesting. But crabs are definitely a big part of their diet, and they're definitely always looking for anything that's scooting along like a crab.
So how is the fly fishing community in Cape Cod? I mean, is it something that's growing? Is it big enough to rival gear, or is it still, you know, pretty small?
It's pretty big. I mean, I think there's a rival gear. I think the issue is more, rivaling a few different types of fisheries in some respects, because I think you've got, you know, gear and fly fishing for stripers, and fewer people are fly fishing for blues, that's for sure. But then you have, you know, the whole everybody going for tuna and stuff like that, which is a much bigger operation, and you gotta obviously figure that out. But the fly fishing community, I think, is pretty strong on Cape Cod. You still have, you know, the shops. It's only kind of one part. There was a fly fishing shop that had opened in Dennis, and it didn't last. And that was kind of surprising to me. I mean, it wasn't, maybe it was the location, maybe it was something else, but it was all fly fishing, and they had a great, you know, bunch of stuff in there. And I thought that was going to stick around, and it didn't. I mean, as far as Massachusetts goes, I think up and down the coast, I think the fly fishing community is growing, and a lot of people will come down here to do it. But you look at places like Bear's Den in Taunton, which is just an awesome shop. It's got everything, and it's just, you know, you're just talking about fly fishing. It's such a fantastic location. The guy in there is a guru as far as figuring out what gear to have in there for whatever you're doing. A lot of people will just go there. The fishing shops on the Cape, some of them have gone away, and a lot of people were talking about that being because of the seals. But then you look at some place like Goose Hummock, which is expanding. I mean, they opened up another shop themselves in Dennis, and they have, you know, certainly a fly fishing section. They have a fly fishing guy, and it's just not, you know, they're also doing the tuna. They're also doing, obviously, you know, other things, the gear stuff more than fly fishing. But I think, you know, I think the fly fishing community on the Cape probably rivals gear, if you exclude kind of tuna and stuff like that.
You've mentioned seals a couple times. What's wrong with seals? I mean, are they eating the stripers? Are you not able to fish around them? Do they like bother the fishermen? What's up with seals? This is coming from a total novice. I'm sorry.
Oh no, not at all. Again, it's a huge conversation that's been going on here on a lot of levels. And personally, I don't know that I don't know that there's anything wrong with seals. I'm not a scientist. I think what you're looking at right now is the results of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. There are 50,000 seals estimated that come to Cape Cod and beach on Cape Cod. And Monomoy is a very isolated location, so that's primarily where they were. But they've expanded their territory, maybe re-expanded, if you will, because if you think that they were historically in different places up the coast and into the bay, and you're starting to see them in areas where, at least in terms of, you know, 30-year, 50-year baseline, you didn't see them up in, you know, coves and in little ponds further up the estuaries. And the concern that people have is multifold. Fishermen, especially in the Nauset Beach area, would watch these seals go back and forth in front of them in huge numbers, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And that coincided, obviously, with the time when stripers, I guess maybe 40 years ago in the 80s, when stripers were in trouble. And so they, you know, correlated that. You know, whether that was the reason, I think we saw changes in regulations that seem to have resulted in the striper striper populations rebounding and doing pretty well. The latest stock assessment wasn't great, but it still doesn't go anywhere near what the problems were back in the late 70s and early 80s. But they looked at the seals, and those seals were there at the same time that they were seeing fewer and fewer stripers. So they said, oh, the seals are definitely the problem. And that started to build itself into the story. And then more recently, the seals are definitively attracting the sharks. So that's kind of involving a whole nother community of surfers and vacation businesses and things of that nature, who are all very concerned about the ramifications of that. If you can't go to Nauset Beach and go swimming, are you going to come to the Cape and spend money? So that conversation has expanded now beyond fishermen concerned about catching stripers to the broader community in terms of what to, in air quotes, do about the seal population. Really anything, it sounds like, from everybody we've talked to, that you can do about the seal population. A, there's a federal law that says you can't do anything about them. Even if you started to talk about a cull, you'd be talking about a massive, massive cull because there are so many of them. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with seals. There are a lot of people who do say there's something wrong with having this many seals about. There could be something, you know, scientifically out of balance, but I think that's a little bit why the sharks are here. We've also seen a little closer to shore, it seems like from the reports, orcas coming near the Cape as close as 3 miles. So are they coming because of the seals? Are they coming because they also are great whites only potential predator? That whole balance is, I think, hard to estimate like what's supposed to be there. I think stripers have been doing pretty well in recent years. So even with all those seals, if you look at the reports and you look at what people are bringing in, there are still big stripers. There's a lot of stripers. There's small stripers. There's any kind of size you really want out there. You may not be able to catch them at the exact place you want to catch them at, but I think they're still there. And I think the kind of balance, it may be actually righting itself a little bit. And we'll see how that goes with, again, the sharks and the seals. But the sharks aren't going to eat all the seals. You can't cull all the seals. They're pretty much here to stay, and you just gotta figure out how to work around them. Scientists have said that it's not necessarily, I think, that they're eating a bunch of stripers. They could be competing with stripers for what the stripers are eating, so it could have an effect on the population that way. That could be a different type of effect than people are really thinking about. People are just thinking about the seal munching on a striper, but that seal's also eating a lot of other things and eats a lot that the striper may be going after. So there's that issue as well, beyond just them eating stripers.
And it also seems like the striper's just a magnificent sport fish. And you had mentioned a commercial season for them. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing many anglers catch and keeping stripers, or are you seeing a lot more catch and release?
A lot more catch and release, I'd say. That's really becoming an aesthetic that a lot of people are following at this point. It's interesting because you talk about the commercial fishery. That assessment I mentioned, one of the things that kind of came out of that and came up in the last year or so, was not necessarily, I mean, the commercial harvest really pales in comparison to the recreational harvest here in Massachusetts. It's very small. So I think, you know, some people do like focus on the commercial fishery, and certainly it's something to keep an eye on. But recreational anglers, just because of the sheer number of them, do take a lot of these fish out of the system. And the other thing that's happening, and they were looking at these numbers, is the catch and release. The catch and release mentality, when done right, you know, potentially good. But when somebody's like, oh, yeah, I'm catch and release, and they're just throwing a fish back right after pulling it out of the water and not worrying about whether it's ready to go back, becomes a real issue. There's a 9%, I think, mortality rate on catch and release. So that's a decent sized number of those, in the air quotes, they are catch and release fish that aren't surviving. So people are looking at different ways to improve that, you know, circle hooks for one thing, if you're bait fishing. But that whole release scenario I was talking about is where people are trying to do it a little better, and whether that's going to help with that number is an open question. The commercial fishery, again, just doesn't take as much as the recreational fishery. I had an interesting conversation with one of my colleagues when I worked at the paper. A lot of times we talk about this, and you talk about the Cape Cod Canal, where there's tons of people, easy access. You know, you can go down there and you can catch cows, you can catch huge fish. I don't spend a lot of time there. I don't like being elbow to elbow. I like getting out and into kind of more wild areas, if you will. But it's an area that, you know, provides a lot of people with an opportunity to catch these big fish. And he would, you know, he might say, well, you know, the recreational guys are poaching like crazy down there. And my argument, and it was a collegial discussion, if you will, but was that it's basically three different people you're talking about. You're talking about recreational guys, you're talking about commercial guys, both playing by the rules, and then you're talking about poachers and or people who are high grading. And that's a different person. That's, you know, they may have a recreational license, they may have a commercial license, but really they're just a flat out criminal. So yeah, that enforcement question is a big one. The Massachusetts Environmental Police has a difficult time patrolling, you know, the whole state with the numbers of officers they have. And the canal, you know, I've heard from them, they could go up and down the canal 24 hours a day and probably catch people poaching or high grading or doing different things like that, but they'd still be happening. So, you know, I got to think that self-enforcement, if you will, or people, and I don't want to say ratting out on each other, but really taking a stand when they see something happening and not getting knifed for it, but at least, you know, speaking up for themselves. And obviously there's a lot of that going on social media, and that's one thing, but when you're out and about talking to people, education, explaining to people why it's important not to, you know, throw a dead fish back in the water or take more than you're supposed to, that all has to go into it.
Speaking of social media, being a new guide, how does that play into your philosophy and your new business plan?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, I certainly am just getting started, so I'm trying to be out there a little bit more, and word of mouth, social media is, you know, a way to do that. I don't know if in the long run, you know, I'll be posting photos from every trip or anything like that. But it is helpful. And one of the things that I've mentioned to a few people that was really interesting to me is when I kind of first did a soft launch of the business, I actually just changed my position on LinkedIn or something like that, which I didn't actually think too hard about, but I didn't do much with LinkedIn for years and years and years. I just kind of had my, you know, newspaper positions on there, maybe updated it once during that time and didn't post really anything. But I put it up there. I just changed my position. I think LinkedIn took it as a promotion. So they were like, congratulate Patrick on his promotion. I definitely wasn't a promotion. I'm not making much money. And I guess a promotion as far as lifestyle goes might be the correct way to look at it. But put it out there. I put it, you know, started the Facebook page, started the Instagram, started the Twitter account, all that stuff. And the first four inquiries I had, one was from LinkedIn, one was from Facebook, one was from Twitter, and one was from Instagram. So the point is that, you know, somebody might be like, oh, I'm just going to do Instagram or I'm just going to do Facebook in terms of kind of getting the word out. There are different people in those different places. And I think that from a business perspective, it was interesting to me because, you know, it proved to me that kind of being on all those platforms was probably a pretty good thing. And then the website, you know, making sure that that's, you know, looks good. And I'm going to be hopefully updating it more frequently going forward now that I've kind of got my feet underneath me a bit, making sure that when people, and then, you know, Google, just from a, again, this is talking business now, making sure you got your Google reviews and Google business in place. That the last guy who got in touch with me said, oh, I Googled and I found you through Google and I liked your website. So all those different, you know, avenues to get to people, I think, are really important, and word of mouth. I think that's, probably the biggest one. People go out, they have a good time with you, they tell their friends, whatever. You're not a jerk. That's goal one. And they have an experience, and that for me, that experience is a big deal, and making sure that they, get out on the boat, the boat's clean, I'm helpful. They, feel comfortable, they feel safe. They catch fish, obviously, is the goal, but at the same time, maybe they also see a whale, or they, they learn something about sharks, or they do this or that, and they go back with a story. And that's, to me, coming from my background in journalism, sharing a story with people and having them able to share a story with the people they know, I think it's good business. And whether or not I get another client from it or not, that shared experience is really what I'm going for.
So you want to come off acting professional, like having all your microphones work correctly and not getting fucking pinging and buzzing in your ears?
Hey, I've been there. I feel for you. That's absolutely understand what that's like. So and on, it's the truth. On any fishing charter, nothing's going to go perfect, or everything's not going to go perfect. Something's going to happen, a line's going to snap, or knots, not going to be perfect. You make sure it is most of the time, and you have a great show despite a rocky start.
That's right, man. Hey, and you had mentioned the Googleator and the Twitter machine. Where can people go find you?
Yeah, at Cape Cod on the Fly, pretty much gets you everything. Twitter, Instagram, and if they Google Cape Cod on the Fly, I think it'll pretty much come up. Still working on that whole SEO, but it's starting to pop a little bit. And Facebook, .com/ Cape Cod on the Fly. So everything, you can pretty much put an at in front of Cape Cod on the Fly and you'll find me.
Here's a little life hack you just gave to us. If you're ever having a rough day, just go promote yourself on LinkedIn, right?
Yeah,
give
exactly.
yourself a damn promotion. Pat yourself on the back.
It was shocking. I didn't realize I was getting promoted, but I'll take it.
There you go.
I'm still waiting for the pay raise, but whatever.
It's coming.
Yeah.
So, Patrick, is there anything we haven't hit on that you would like to?
No, I mean, I kind of talked about what was important to me, which is people's experience. And I guess the only other thing I'd say, which is important as far as my experience in starting this business, was the amount of people that helped me do it. Whether it's my wife, friends, my family, people doing stuff for free, people jumping in with skills that I didn't know they had. So if you're, out there thinking about doing something, whether it's fishing related or something totally different, and you look around, I think you'd be surprised as to how helpful friends, family, and just acquaintances can be in that situation. And I'm eternally grateful for it.
That's how we got hooked up with you. A mutual friend of ours, Nick Mayer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meeting him was a great experience on a lot of different levels. Nick's a great guy, and looking forward to following Predator Fly Gear, and his art is incredible. So anybody who hasn't looked at that should go check it out. NickMayerArt.com, I think, is what it is.
Yeah, it's out of this world. Cool. Well, hey, we appreciate you coming on, taking the time. It was good to get to talk to you, and kind of look forward to seeing how your business progresses also.
Well, I appreciate it, guys, I'm gonna keep following you guys along, and looking forward to listening to your podcast going forward. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Whoops,
that worked too.
After this ad,
ladies and gentlemen, introducing you.